This is the age of deception, and the world is balanced upon a razor. One half is scheduled to be exterminated if these people have their way, and the other half is scheduled to be enslaved when the mystical union between the moon and the sun.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Canadian it's Ron Mandel, also Manfred Petrich from Abkhazia. So what if some election loser like Tommy Robinson turns up in Bristol, says that Marvin Rees, our mayor, cheated in the election and declares himself mayor, with his followers taking over Bristol City Council's senior management, Tommy Robinson running the city, and then London and Brussels back Tommy? Well, that's what happened in Venezuela this week, up to a point. Maduro is facing some kind of coup attempt, but as with Chavez in 2002, the Venezuelan army are standing firm on top of the greatest oil deposits anywhere in the world. And McCarthyism, is it alive and well and even thriving within the Labour anti-Semitism row? Are those comparisons really justified? And have you ever heard of the Magnitsky Act? The US has passed it. Now the EU is following suit. We speak to author and financier Alex Krainer. He's Croatian, but he lives down in France. He's also written a book called The Bill Browder Hoax, all about Sergei Magnitsky. He was the accountant for the Moscow-based hedge fund manager Bill Browder. Putin ejected Browder. And when Magnitsky died in prison, Browder says Putin had him murdered. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week we take a look at the grand solar minimum, asking the question, could this also seriously affect climate if it happens in the next few years? A 30-year cycle, apparently, from the mid-20s to the mid-50s could cause more climate change. And this is all due down to sunspots. We talked to Nick from Shirehampton about it. As well as long-time campaigner and social justice campaigner Thalia Campbell. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.com.co.uk. We start by looking at Venezuela this week, and we'll go down the line to Abkhazia, to the author of the All Smoke and Mirrors blog. It's actually written in German, but of course these days you can get your web browser to translate that into English fairly easily. Alice Schau und Rausch. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Manfred Petrich, welcome to the Politics Show.
Yes, hello, and I'm glad to be with you again this evening.
Now, Manfred, what do you make of what's happened in Venezuela this week?
Well, what we are seeing now is a kind of a culmination of Washington's attempt to do a regime change in Venezuela, which has been going on since a long time, back to Chavez. So it's a kind of a culmination now with this Juan Guaido declaring himself the interim president, and Trump immediately recognizing him as the legitimate president, and that Nicolas Maduro has to step down.
Now, I was amazed to hear, chatting to you earlier, that you've actually got a Venezuelan passport. How did you come across that? Are you a multiple citizen? Have you got one of those people that's got like 10 passports on the shelf?
Well, you know, I've been on this planet for a long time, and I did a lot of traveling in my life, and I lived nearly on all continents, except in in the Antarctica. I've lived on all continents, and therefore I kind of collected passports in that time. And one of them, I lived 6 years in Venezuela, in Caracas. And so I became also a Venezuelan citizen through my father.
Could you tell us a bit about what life is like in Venezuela for someone that spent a bit of time there?
Well, when I was there, you know, that's a long time ago. That was at the end of the 50s and 60s. It was a very modern country. Caracas was very modern with a lot of skyscrapers and everything. So it was a Western type of society. And, of course, there were typically also slum areas, just like in Brazil and other places in South Africa, there was a South America. So there was a big difference between, let's say, the middle class and the poor people. And it was totally at that time under American control. And that's why I think the people then decided later on to go more socialistic route by electing Chavez, etc. So that the income from the rich oil resources doesn't go to the American oil companies, but to the is used for the people.
And let's also just bring in Ron Mandel, who's still with us. Ron, what do you make of the relationship between North America and South America, particularly here with Venezuela?
Well, I think the latest developments in Venezuela have been carefully orchestrated by the United States, along with countries like Colombia, Argentina, and Brazil, which all have right-wing governments, and obviously with the National Assembly in Venezuela. The United States historically basically has always been a bully in Latin America, basically assuming that they know best for the countries in that region. And all you have to look back on is Cuba, the relationship between Cuba and the United States and the attempts of the United States to unseat or overthrow the revolution led by Fidel Castro in 1959. But in Venezuela, you have an interesting situation. I'm not quite sure if you describe it as a coup, but basically as an attempt basically to put Maduro on the defensive. And I think you're quite right. I think it's backfired because the military to a general has basically announced its loyalty to Maduro and say Maduro is the only legitimate leader of Venezuela.
Well, were you surprised to see Donald Tusk come out in support of the interim president rather than Maduro? I certainly was.
Yes, I was. But I think, you know, diplomatically, I think nothing happens by chance. I think the United States was possibly lobbying the EU and its allies. And I found most objectionable was Pence's attempt to bribe the Venezuelan people to overthrow Maduro, whatever you might think of Maduro, and we can get to that later, we'll provide $20 million in humanitarian aid to help the Venezuelan people basically to overcome the effects of Maduro's rule. It's an attempt to bribe the Venezuelan people. If the United States was sincere, they would offer them humanitarian aid with no strings attached. So I think it's, once again, an example of U.S. imperialism.
Isn't this always the way, though? I mean, we've seen a similar thing going on, actually, Ron, in Zimbabwe with their economy screaming. And don't the IMF and the international financiers make someone's economy scream if they don't like them?
Well, the IMF basically has this process called conditionality, where they provide loans to countries, provide those countries due something in return, and normally that leads to privatization of natural resources, cutbacks in social welfare expenditures, opening the countries to more foreign investment, which allows those transnational corporations basically to rape the national resources of those countries.
I mean, isn't that just doing business? That's the normal way of business, surely.
Yeah, that's global capitalism, yes.
Manfred, what do you make of what Ron's saying there about the U.S. dominance in Venezuela over a long time?
Well, it's absolutely correct. that's their, has been their policy for I don't know, half a century or longer. For instance, John Perkins described this very well in his book, The Economic Hitman, because he was an insider and he described what happens when a new president is elected, and then people from Washington come and say, congratulations, Mr. President, but one thing you have to, we want to remind you, all those social programs that you promised during your election campaign, you can just forget, because in one pocket we have $100 million for you and your family, and in the other pocket we have a gun with a bullet with your name on it. So you can choose what you want to do. And Chavez actually confirmed these threats, and he said exactly that happened to him. That means that after an election, many presidents just, they succumb to these threats and then change their policy. And those that don't do it, that's what happens to them, what we are seeing now. And don't forget also what Ron Mandel just said, this economic hardship is caused by America, because they have been punishing Venezuela for a long, long time. So it's not only the policy of Chavez and Maduro, it's also a lot has to do with the sanctions and all the things that America is imposing on Venezuela.
Now, right? Now, Manfred, what about the oil? That must be a factor.
Well, a lot of people are saying that the reduction of the oil price, what the tactic behind that was to reduce the income for all the oil dependent countries like Russia and also Venezuela, so that they have less money to support their economies and their social programs. And one thing I want to tell you, which not many people know, a lot of this strategy was done through Colombia, and Colombia is quasi a NATO member. Did you know this? Colombia is a NATO member since last year and is a so-called global partner of NATO.
Well,
so they are doing this through Colombia by undermining the neighboring country, Venezuela.
Okay, do you want to just give us your take on the relationship then, Manfred, between Colombia and, because they're right next door to each other, and some people are saying that it's potential that Brazil and Colombia could even invade Venezuela.
That's right, and what we could have then is a NATO intervention that can happen there. Right.
And I noticed that about a month or so ago, there were some Russian nuclear-capable bombers turned up just for a little fly-past and landed in Venezuela. So, I mean, do you think the Cold War is really moving over to South America now?
Well, what Moscow is doing is giving a signal to Washington to be careful. And that's also what the foreign minister of Russia said yesterday, that America should not even think of military intervention in Venezuela. So, obviously, Moscow is standing behind Venezuela and showing this with this deployment or of these aircraft to Venezuela. And that means, there could be really something happening there if both sides don't, restrain themselves.
Now, Ron mentioned Mike Pence. We're going to hear from him now. And this is what he had to say yesterday about the election of Maduro and what he believes is the legitimate overturning of it.
Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. The National Assembly is the duly elected representative of the people, and through their constitutional system, and now the interim president, Juan Guaido, it represents the will of the people. We hope that Nicolas Maduro will accept a peaceful transition of power in Venezuela, that he will accept the will of the people to move his country forward and embrace their new president, Juan Guaido.
And Mr. Pence spoke directly to the Venezuelan people.
the American people stand with you. We see this as a hemisphere of freedom, and we will stand with the people of Venezuela until they reclaim freedom and democracy for their people.
Well, I think Mike Pence has very selectively interpreted the Venezuelan Constitution, because the Constitution basically does not preclude Maduro staying in power. He basically has been reaffirmed as president following the constitutional means. The National Assembly will be the equivalent of Congress in the United States. So how do you believe that the Congress of the United States could nominate an alternative president if they felt that the election of Trump was basically illegitimate? That is basically the analogy I would draw. Now, it doesn't nullify that there is a political crisis in Venezuela. There's a crisis going back ever since Chavez died. I think Maduro has not been the leader that has Chavez's charisma. I think he's been made some political mistakes. I think he's come down much too hard on the opposition, even the opposition, which was not violent, peacefully protesting. There are some reason to believe that he's used the courts basically to nullify the victory of the National Assembly by his opponents. And Maduro's been playing a very clever game in one sense, because the reason why he has the loyalty of the military is because he's been paying them very heavy salaries and also allowing them to sit on the boards of the National Oil Company and basically profiting from those arrangements. So Maduro, I think, is in a tricky situation. It'll be interesting to see how he's going to play it, whether or not he's going to try to tough it out, or whether he will try to reach out to the opposition to try to negotiate some kind of solution, which I think is going to be very difficult to arrive at, given the polarization that's taking place.
Manfred, I wonder how you think this is going to play out. Guaido, it's very difficult for Maduro to really tolerate somebody who's going around in his own country saying, you're not the president, I am.
Of course. Everything that Ron says is correct. The thing is that the so-called opposition, they are completely controlled by Washington. I mean, that's not a real opposition. I mean, just based on internal Venezuelan things, it's a controlled opposition from the outside. And that is, of course, a big problem to convince people that this is happening, you know, through NGOs and fifth columns, which, and also the media. Don't forget, the media in Venezuela is controlled by elements which are also, you know, run by Washington, and also the exiled Venezuelans who stole all the money and moved to Miami and are stirring up this hate also, right? So, of course, Maduro is a big problem now, and therefore, let's see what China and also Russia is doing in the Security Council and things like that. And China is involved here because they have invested a lot into the oil industry there.
Now, back in 2002, there was another coup attempt in Venezuela. There's a fantastic film, which I'll put a link up to on our show page, called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. This was another attempt to oust. This was Chavez back in 2002. But do you think they'll succeed? I'm asking you the $64,000 question, Manfred. What's going to happen now?
Well, if I could see the future, I would go into a casino and put the chip on the right numbers. But I think what can happen is that the whole thing will be reduced. Who has the biggest guns? You know, there will be maybe a kind of like I recall civil war happening there. It could be that the whole thing will be resolved with guns. Right, and that is a big problem, right?
Well, let's hope not. Let you finish, Ron, on just explaining why it is that America does feel like it has to interfere in places like Venezuela.
Well, it's not new. It's not novel to this time. The analogy I would draw in terms of, I think, with the blueprint for the United States' attempt to regime change in Venezuela is what took place when Allende was president of Chile between 1970 and 1973. The United States did everything possible to destabilize Chile. It worked with the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, basically, to destabilize the Chilean economy. The United States subsidized the lorry drivers who went on strike. They worked with whole levels of society, basically, to make the situation untenable for Allende, and tried to trigger, and which they succeeded to do, a coup against Allende, which was the first 9/11. September 11th, 1973. That is the blueprint for what they're trying to do in Venezuela. I think they probably miscalculated because of the solid support that the military has provided Maduro. I don't have a crystal ball. I think we'll basically see a stalemate. I'm short of violence, which I don't see a violent uprising taking place because I don't think there is the resources for that. And I think the military will squash any attempt basically to use violence to unseat Maduro.
You talking about the Chile coup, is it your understanding, certainly it's my understanding, that it was Henry Kissinger behind that?
Yes.
How did he do it?
Yeah, the very time he won the Nobel Peace Prize, which was basically shambolic, to say the very least.
Manfred, have you been following Kissinger over the years? He seems to be one of the sort of people who, whilst he was Secretary of State, he did these things and he just couldn't stop, even after he wasn't Secretary of State anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Henry Kissinger is one of those criminals who has caused not only in Chile but also in Argentina. He did interventions to remove governments and put in the military government there in Argentina. So, as we said, this is the standard praxis of the American government, because for Washington, South America, Latin America is their backyard, and they control everything that's happening there. And any socialist country, a country that does not serve the interest of the big corporations and the banks, is removed in some way or undermined, and the people are punished with sanctions and all that to break down or bring down the government. That's standard practice in Latin America and also in other places like Middle East and so forth. So like what they're doing with Iran and so forth. So that means they always talk about democracy, but when a democracy happens, then it doesn't turn out the way they want. Then it's not democracy. Then, Mike Pence in his speech on TV just said that Maduro is a dictator. Right? That's the typical language they always use. Everybody is then always a dictator. Assad is a dictator. Saddam Hussein was a dictator. Putin is a dictator. They're all dictators. And from that you can always see, aha, he is obviously not following Washington's orders. Right.
One of the things that bothers me, Ron, is that we don't get the mainstream press, the BBC, ITV, often don't pull them up when they say these things.
No, they don't. But the point I would want to make, I think our listeners need to realize that there is a tendency to overstate the power of the United States, that the United States can manipulate situations, they can do anything they want to. I don't think that's true. I think the United States has a history of trying to pick on vulnerable countries or vulnerable governments, like it did with Saddam Hussein. They knew, the United States knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. The neoconservative agenda was basically to unseat Saddam Hussein. Likewise, they did this, they're trying to do so in Venezuela now, because they see Maduro as being very vulnerable. He's put on the defensive. They have the alliance of major South American states basically trying to unseat Maduro. The analogy with Iran, I think, is very interesting, because Iran is a relatively stable government, despite the economic difficulties. And Iran is a country that the United States well, trying to form an alliance with Saudi Arabia and Israel to isolate Iran, I don't think that they're going to be able to achieve regime change in Iran. I think the strategy ultimately is to try to contain influence in Iran, which I think is going to be very difficult given the situation in Syria, which could be a show in itself.
Okay, one thing we ought to mention whilst talking about Venezuela is the channel, which doesn't really go along with what Manfred was saying about the private TV, which is called Telesur English, and they're well worth a look. Andrei Vilcek, who was on this programme a couple of months ago, he does documentaries for them still, and it's great to know that you've actually got English language news coming out of Venezuela. Incredible. And it's not just a privately funded, private interest organisation. One of the things they're saying right now is that the progressive US lawmakers, obviously this is from a pro-Maduro point of view, progressive US lawmakers reject US interventionism in Venezuela. So there's already a backlash within the US one.
Yeah, but that's very interesting. I didn't realize that, but I think there is a tradition within the United States Congress, basically against overseas interventions, and questioning basically the power of the United States president, the executive branch, basically to intervene without justification.
Okay, before we come back home to look at some stories here in the UK which have got international implications, let's just have a quick look at Zimbabwe, because I spotted a fascinating story yesterday. I mean, they've got all sorts of problems there, again, with the economy, has a similar sort of thing as was going on in Venezuela. But we've had also Mnangagwa, the new president, is being severely criticised now because of the security forces' violence towards protesters against the doubling of fuel prices in Zimbabwe. Now, Manfred, what the army are saying is that they've got bogus elements. That is to say, people who are not part of the Zimbabwean army, dressed up in Zimbabwean army uniform, responsible for beating and killing civilians in some parts of the country. Now, I mean, this is very difficult from this far away to work out whether this is just fake news by the government trying to get rid of the blame for them killing civilians in Zimbabwe, or whether there might really be, is it feasible there might really be outside forces using Zimbabwe army uniforms coming into villages and killing people?
Well, of course. The South African government just announced that they want to intervene in Zimbabwe. So it just is absolutely possible that from the neighboring countries, rogue elements come in and kind of hide under Zimbabwe uniforms to implement the policies of the neighboring countries and stir up trouble. But I just want to go back a little bit just for a minute regarding Venezuela and the USA. Every foreign policy is also internal policy. So what could also be a factor why they are doing it now, Trump is doing this, is to distract from his tremendous internal political problems that want to dispose him. So he wants to attract attention to the outside because of his internal problems. Just to finish this off.
No, that's a good point. And Ron, as someone who's born in the US, do you think that's a valid thing to point out?
Yeah, I think that's a plausible explanation. But I think it's interesting. I haven't heard any justifications for US behavior based on national security interests. It's more basically the United States is doing this because they want to defend democracy. But I think, yes, you're quite right. There is a possible explanation, you know, that Trump has been put on the political defensive, particularly over the shutdown of the government and his obsession with building the wall, which is proving very unpopular with the American electorate. So this could be seen as a way of distracting attention from his political...
But the shutdown, this is amazing. The no government in your country, although I must... Well, I say your country, where you were born.
But still, I'm still a U.S. citizen, so...
Okay, you're one of these people with various passports, are you?
No, well, only one.
I'm not asking you about that. Don't worry. You don't have to say anything about how many passports you've got or where. But, this does strike me as there are quite extreme elements within the Republican Party that would quite like to shut down government permanently and let the corporations run it. Let Wall Street run the country.
Well, there's a problem with that because they're basic services that most American citizens still depend on. And people think of the government just being based in Washington. There are many federal employees throughout the 50 states of the United States who provide vital services, everything from providing Social Security, that's the pensions for American citizens, for running U.S. parks, for running health clinics, and so forth. And it's just a shame that the President of the United States is using as pawns federal employees to try to get what he wants.
What about my point about some, you know, more extreme forces in the Republicans? Actually, they don't really like government. They'd rather it was gone.
Yeah, I don't think you'll find that too many people in Congress possibly are arguing that because Congress basically has responsibility to defend the national government. But you might, there are fringes within the Republican Party. There are think tanks basically say that the U.S. state is too bloated. It's full with bureaucrats, and you would save American taxpayers a great deal of money by actually shrinking the state.
So when do you think... is there going to be a deal on the shutdown, do you think?
Oh, yes, I think eventually there will be a deal. I don't know what kind of deal there will be, but there will have to be a deal. It's very interesting that Trump is trying to backtrack in some sense of anti-immigrant rhetoric by offering an extension, basically, of a law, which is known as the Dreamers, which would basically not penalize the children brought in illegally into the United States when they were very young, that they basically retain certain basic rights within the United States, and also to have a 3-year moratorium, basically, on expelling people illegally in the United States. That shows how desperate he is. I'm not quite sure if he's going to get his wall. He might get some tightened security measures, which might satisfy Trump. But the thing you have to understand about Trump, I don't think Trump has any strong beliefs one way or the other. I think he's playing to his political base. He realizes that his popularity has diminished within the electorate, and he knows that he lost the popular vote in 2016. The only way he can be reelected in 2020 is by maintaining the solidity of his political base. If he starts to lose any support from his political base, he's finished. I think all his decisions are motivated by that.
Yeah, his political base voted for a wall, didn't they?
Exactly right. Well, with some immigration, stricter immigration controls, and that's exactly right. So I think that's what he's playing to. But I think, as a businessman, I think he realized that sometimes you can't always get what you want, and you might have to sell for less.
Well, I mean, his book, The Art of the Deal, isn't it, where he's actually saying, this is brinkmanship, and this is exactly what he's doing with Congress right now.
Yes.
Manfred, what do you make of what's happening with the shutdown in the United States, and how long do you think it'll last?
Well, I think there is a different problem. I think the problem in the United States is that society is completely split in half, and that these extreme liberals and whatever you call them, and all this feminism and gendering and so forth has such an extreme form that I just want to say, kind of like a joke, I want to tell you that I now identify as a mermaid, and I want you to use the right pronouns, please. You understand? This is all happening in America, and it's absolutely terrible what is happening, and especially here in Russia, people are just shaking their heads and saying, are they gone completely nuts over there?
I mean, right. do you think it's someone's right? You know, someone's right to change gender if they want to.
Well, of course they can, but then I can say, why don't we change also the age? I feel like a 20-year-old. I want to change my age. How far do we want to go?
Okay.
How far do we want to go to change whatever nature has given you? Right.
Okay, Ron. I wonder.
Especially when they are forcing it on people, right?
And gender reassignments. Well, that's a tricky issue. I think people are, you know, I mean, gender is a construct anyway. It's not a biological determinant. So if a man feels that he's a woman inside, well, you know, that what's what he wants to express or release, I cannot see why there should be any restrictions to do so. I do understand that there is some controversy within the women's movement about that, because women feel that some men basically may have ulterior motives, and there's a question of safe zones and security and so forth. So I don't think there's an easy answer to it, but I think there is what we uphold is the right of gender reassignment.
Okay, now I'll just put the questions about Zimbabwe to you. What do you think is going on there? I mean, this is an old British colony. Reuters are saying the Zimbabwe army is blaming bogus soldiers for the brutality and the killings.
I think that's far-fetched. If that is the case, what is the Zimbabwe army doing to corral those elements and basically holding them accountable? I think it's more likely there might be rogue elements within the Zimbabwe army which have taken matters into their own hands, and that the government is too embarrassed to admit that. But then again, you know, governments are never known for their honesty and transparency, whatever government we're talking about. You know, so I would not see the Zimbabwe government to be an exception to that.
Well, it just seems that so many African countries after the colonial era have had a really hard time. I mean, it's probably fair to say all over the world, ex-colonial countries, and now that is coming home in Zimbabwe. I mean, there must be some Zimbabweans are thinking, actually, this is less likely to happen, this kind of mass rioting and massive increase in fuel, if Mugabe was still there.
I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I don't have my finger on the pulse of the Zimbabwe electorate to know how they feel.
What do you make of Mnangagwa anyway? Have you had a look at him?
When
he was first elected, I can remember people were saying, well, is this the right guy? He was in charge of those riots we had, whatever, 15 years ago, and many people died in them, and he's now going to be taking over.
Yeah, I think that was possibly to reassure the governing party, basically, there was not going to be any major changes. I think you're quite right. His pedigree basically is questionable. I think Zimbabwe politics might benefit from a new leadership, a new generation of leaders.
Right, well, we're going to come back to the UK now and look at a quite extraordinary and hardly covered at all announcement, which was down at a place where I nearly applied for a job, actually, years ago. I worked in Salisbury for the BBC in 1993, and it was all being just set up at the time. It's called Spire FM. It was a commercial channel based in Salisbury. And this time, last Saturday, onto the radio popped this person who was the first person, along with her mum, on the scene at the Skripal poisoning. Her name is Abigail McCourt, and she was first to find Yulia Skripal and Sergei Skripal on a bench in Salisbury having some problems breathing. So let's have a listen to her now.
So it was the 4th of March, and it was my brother's birthday, and so we were out celebrating, and we were coming home, and I saw them on the bench, and at this point people were still walking past. I don't think anyone had really noticed them, and I was telling my mum, like, I think because I thought he was having a heart attack, and so we went over, and obviously it developed from there, and then we went home, and the next day I was talking to some of my friends about it, and then at break someone Snapchatted me and was like, is this the thing you were talking about? And I was like, okay, wow. I was a bit shocked, to be honest, because I don't think I was expecting anything near that to have happened, and I was just like, I need to phone my mum, like, wow, and see if she was okay. And yeah, it was just a bit surreal, really.
So that was the voice of a certain Abigail McCourt. The interesting thing is, though, Manfred, maybe we can get your comment on this, that her mother... Her mother is the senior nurse in the British Army. She's also a colonel, and she's pictured outside number 10 with 6, I think it is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 no, six medals on her chest, and she was the first person on the scene. So Sergei and Yulia Skripal were given first aid by the British Army's most senior nurse, who just happened to be nearby, according to a new report. That's the mum of Abigail, who we heard just then. Now, what do you make of that, Manfred?
Well, when I heard that a couple of days ago, I really was flabbergasted, because if the mother wouldn't have suggested that the daughter should be given this life-saving prize, the whole thing would have never turned up and would have been known. That means for nearly a year now, this news has been hidden, that, as you said, Britain's number one military nurse was the first on the scene. That was never mentioned by the government, never mentioned by the media. The official story was that the police found them, and that one of the police then got sick and had to go to hospital. So my question about this is, of course, how is it possible that this super-duper poison Novichok, which is supposed to kill you in a matter of seconds, these two survived, and also the guys from the from the ambulance who helped and didn't have any problem, and also all these things that they were not infected, so to say, by this huge poison.
Well, yes, I mean, hang on. Yeah, hang on, because I mean, surely this story is well known all around the world. The Novichok was the cause of the poisoning of the Skripals, Yulia and Sergei, and there's been an enormous consequences. We're talking about diplomatic consequences. Scores of diplomats have been sacked as a result. So, what? Why do you question?
Russian diplomats were sent home.
So, why do you question what happened in Salisbury?
Well, I question the fact that those two McCorns, who were the first on the scene to help them, were not affected by this poison. How is that possible? But the official story says that the police who went there, the two policemen, one of them was affected and had to go to hospital.
Okay,
how is that possible?
Okay, so have you got other suspicions about this attack then?
Well, as we know, there is a story that was published the next day that this was not Novichok, but it was a drug which is 1,000 times more potent than heroin, that they were put in there by, treated in hospital for these symptoms. So I think the whole chemical weapon story is complete bullshit.
Ron, sorry about the swearing there, folks. Ron, what do you make of this revelation this week about the... And it's taken a year, pretty much, hasn't it, for us to be told that the first person on the scene was a mother and daughter, one of whom, the mother, who's a colonel in the British Army, the most senior British nurse we've got.
Yeah, it is a bit troublesome, because my understanding is the police knew this from the get-go, and they basically squashed any attempts, basically released the information to the media. It raises all kinds of questions about how reliable other sources of information have been officially released by the police. And it depends on your way of thinking, and some people are much more prone to think about conspiracies, and this might be a cover-up, basically, to draw attention away from the British government's responsibility. That could be one possible explanation, and probably a far-fetched one, to try to draw doubts, basically, on whether or not the Russians actually were behind this attack against two Russian citizens. So it's hard to make sense of it. And I think it's the lack, again, of transparency, which actually, I think, draws attention to the fact that possibly other things that we've been told may not be exactly true either.
Okay. Manfred, is there anything else about this story that troubles you?
Yes, there is. I think there is a much bigger story behind it, and that is that the handler of a Skripal, of this double agent, this MI6 agent, is worked for the same company as Steele, who created this so-called dirty dossier for the Democratic Party to throw dirt onto Trump. I mean, there's a huge connection, and maybe the Skripals were removed because they were using him to find dirt on Trump in Russia. So there is a definite connection to the company called, what is it called?
Orbis Business Intelligence.
Yeah, Orbit Intelligence. Because Steele and the handler of the Skripal was working for Orbit.
Okay.
So there is something happening there.
Okay, can you give us, Manfred, in a nutshell, your view of the tension that's now building? I mean, it has been since this incident, and actually since before that, between NATO. It's like almost like a kind of new Cold War between Russia and NATO.
Well, absolutely. What is happening here is, for me and for other people, that this seems to be kind of like a false flag thing that was put in scene, and to blame it on the Russians, so that they can also, in this case, like with Chavez and also Maduro, to show how bad Putin is and how bad Russia is and all these things, so that they have the argument to get tough on Russia and so forth.
It's almost right? Wrong.
And spend more money for the military and move NATO closer to the Russian border and et cetera, et cetera.
Ron, it's almost as if it's becoming more and more difficult to actually be an independent sovereign country anymore. You have to take sides. You have to find one of the big strong superpower guys. Maybe it's been like this for a long time. Otherwise, one of them is going to gobble you up.
Well, it's hard to say about British and Russian relations in terms of what motivates, you know, both countries' perceptions of each other. But I mean, a number of people, commentators, have talked about the Second Cold War. And I think that is an exaggeration. And I think there might be a not-so-hidden agenda among some people trying to push that, basically because they see Russia as being a threat not just to British interests, but basically to interests within NATO as at large.
Okay, well, let's head back over to...
Hang on, I'd like to remind you that the agent... I just looked it up. The agent who was handling the double agent Skripal, his name is Pablo Miller, and that the British government put a D notice to all the media that they are not allowed to mention this name in any of their reports. And so that has been squashed. And the reason for it is so that there can be no connection between the Steely Dirty Dossier thing and the Skripal thing. There is the government of Britain put a D notice, which you know is a censorship notice, onto all the media not to mention Pablo Miller's name.
Well, I must admit,
was the hand of Skripal.
I must admit, I saw Alex Thompson from Channel 4 News tweet precisely that as when this whole thing, the story started to break about the connection between MI6 and Orbis Business Intelligence and the Skripal case. Anyway, we're also joined in a studio by Mohammed Makawi, who's been sitting here patiently for the last 5 minutes. Mohammed, you were originally Sudanese, I believe.
Yes, I am, yeah.
Tell us what's been going on in Sudan. I noticed the headlines on the BBC saying the biggest protest in living memory hit Sudan. Maybe we better start by explaining where it is.
Yeah, it started on the 19th of December last year in the city of Atbara, which is in the middle of the Sudan. It used to be the hub for the railway, similar to like Birmingham here. Most of the citizen of Atbara, they are worker and mainly they are lefty and like communist. The starting of the protest because of, you know, this regime been since 1989 coming with a military coup, and they are like Islamic fundamentalist rule, and they've been ruling for 30 years. But there is so many things bringing the uprising this time, because the uprising has been every year, like. But this time, because the rising of the bread and the rising of the all the essential goods, and the lack of banknotes in the banks, the economy
that's,
is...
You see, that's dangerous, isn't it? So yeah. If you've been saving your money in the bank, you go to the bank and they say, we've run out of banknotes.
Exactly.
That's going to make people angry.
Yeah. And that's exactly what's happened. And that it started on the 19th on one city, and after that is just inflamed everywhere in the Sudan, every city and every day. But the bad things is they are peaceful protesters, but the government or the regime facing them with fire and ammunition, and killing so far like 50 Sudanese. I mean, most of them, they are in young age, like 15 to 24 years old. And most of them, they are like in universities and students. And you're talking about Russia. Russia has been a friend of the al-Bashir, and what's happening in Sudan as interior matters in the Security Council just 3 days ago or 4 days ago. So Russia is not like an innocent, because being supporting Bashar, being supporting Bashir. So Russia is not a good country in our eyes as well. I mean, America is not, Russia is not, Britain is not. So
is there any hope, do you think, for some peace, more peaceful and just resolution in Sudan? It is the biggest country in Africa.
Yeah.
People often forget that. And also, this guy has had a crimes against humanity and war crime arrest warrants out for him from the International Criminal
ICC,
Court for
yeah.
many years.
Yeah.
So,
not only him, because he's been killing our people in Darfur and Nuba Mountain and the Blue Nile. For years and years.
So like, is he working for somebody or just for his own selfish interests?
Not only selfish interests, but for the brotherhoods, because they are coming as a brotherhoods, Islamic brotherhood, sorry, and that's what they are working as. And
So you're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Yeah, Muslim Brotherhood, sorry. And and they are working for their own interest. And it's been like this for 30 years, and no one noticed any of it. And only on 2005 or so, like 11 of them been put in the list of the ICC for a crime against humanity, because they killed about 100,000 in Darfur and Nuba Mountain, and now they're doing the same in all the cities in Sudan. And I don't think it's going to be or end peacefully. We hope that's going to that's the way it's going to happen.
For example, over in Somalia, there was for a while a peaceful resolution under the Islamic court system.
Yeah.
Is there any thoughts about something similar happening in Sudan or not?
No, I don't think so.
So what's the peaceful resolution? What would you like to see happen?
What I like to see them happen just for this regime to give up the rule and hand it over to the not the military, because we don't even trust the military now, and we don't trust no one. Just hand it back to the Sudanese people, because there is a organizations and there is a parties already formed, and they are the leader of this peaceful demonstration.
Okay, have you got anything to add, Ron, to what's happening in Sudan? This is another place where we've got terrible things like food shortages, hiking prices of fuel, this sort of thing. It seems to be a bit of a pattern this week.
Yes, it is, and I think it's
unfortunately seem to be indicative of what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, you have unrest in Democratic Republic of Congo, Central Africa Republic, South Sudan. You still have a civil war going. But the only thing I would add what's really been said is that Bashir has been playing a very interesting diplomatic game. He's been traveling abroad trying to win support for his government. And I think he was the first one to recognize the Assad government in Syria, which is quite remarkable. So you have one dictator holding hands with another dictator. And I think he's just come back from another Middle East country.
Qatar,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where he's basically been trying to win support for his government. I don't know. You might have.
I mean, has he been going around fishing for cash, basically? To
possibly cash, or yeah, exactly. Or economic assistance. Exactly, yeah. Right. Yes,
an arm, and he's been to Russia as well. Mm. He went and met Putin. Even he got a warrant against him.
Anyway, I think what we'll be happy to do with you, Mohammed, is ask you to come in a little bit early for the next few weeks.
No
problem.
Keep
track of this story. Great to have you.
Thank you.
And Manfred, I'm afraid we haven't got time for a comment from you. Just time to say sign off for the Comcast News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook is Mohammed, you just heard there. Thanks very much to Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Celia Phipps, and also Ben Walker from Bradley Stoke in the first hour, and also from Manfred Petrich from All Smoke and Mirrors. I'll put links up to his blog, and also former International Relations Lecturer Ron Mandel. Do please join us for the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.